must know I have a drinking problem. There's 3 glasses of water up here. I am an alcoholic. My name is Pat Jen.
Hey.
Hello, everybody. My sobriety date is July the 5th, 1988. My home group is the Red Door Group. It's a closed meeting in Dofuniak Springs, Florida. My sponsor's name is Susie B. That tells you what I am, who I am, not so important, that I do have a home group with a chair, and that I have a spiritual guide to help me through my living. I sincerely want to thank the Marietta Spring Roundup for asking me to participate. I understand Dave's job quite well, as I just finished being the voice of the 41st Gulf Coast Roundup on Okaloosa Island. I know what goes into putting on a convention, a roundup. It is a lot of work, and it starts the day after this one ends. They've probably already started for the next couple of years. I'm here to tell you my journey of what it was like, what happened, and more importantly, what it's like today. I am the oldest of 4 children. I'm a member of the CIA, Catholic, Irish, alcoholic. My father was a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, served in both World War II and the Korean War, and we were raised with what he called discipline. I've learned today and suspected then that it was a little more than discipline when I had to wear long pants to cover the marks from the belts on my legs. We were never allowed to talk about my daddy's drinking. That was a subject that stayed in the house. You didn't air your dirty laundry. So I did not know there were other people that were experiencing the same thing I was growing up. I have a sister that's 2 years younger, and she doesn't have a problem with alcohol. She either needs to take a drink or go to Al-Anon, though. And she's a little uptight. There are 2 brothers that were 9 and 10 years younger than I am. The older, Jim, had a problem with drinking, and I believe I would call it, and he and I have talked about this, he was a very heavy drinker. He had a little girl late in life, and when she was about 4, he came home from work one night and had, this is for the weekend, and he had his beer with him, and he curled up with her and was going to read her a story, and she said, "Daddy, are you going to drink that beer?" And he said, "Well, yeah, Mackenzie, I was planning on it." And she said, "You stink and act silly when you drink that beer." Out of the mouths of babes. So he knew his sister was in recovery, and he had been given a big book, which he promptly set his beers on. He said it made a good coaster. And so he said, "Well, Mackenzie, would you rather Daddy didn't drink this?" And she said, "Yeah." He pulled a chair over to the sink, he popped the tops, and they poured the beer down the drain, and he's not had a drink since. That story is true in the big book. That can happen. Didn't happen to me. At the age of 38, my youngest brother died from a grand mal seizure as a result of this disease. It kills. So, growing up was what I thought was normal. And I remember we weren't allowed to say anything or rock the boat. We walked on eggshells because we didn't want to get Daddy mad. My dad raged when he was drinking, and things flew through the air. Sometimes it was us. And he was quite a violent man. And I swore with every fiber of my being, I would never be like my daddy. I wished I could tell you that was true. I started drinking when I was about 13 or 14, and I was stealing his booze. And he had a big liquor cabinet, and I'd climb up on the dryer, which was right underneath it, and I'd get in it, and I would take sips of this, different things. They were all pretty colors and different tastes, and I kind of liked it, and didn't correlate that that's why Daddy drank it. He came home every night and had a highball. How many of you have even heard of that? And he had not one, but more. And then he kind of got upset because he noticed the level was going down, so I put more water in it. And I don't know whether he wised up, but I think he probably did. I was 9 years old when my dad had a horrible rage, and the next day, my sister, who was 7, was diagnosed with polio. She was the first diagnosed case in the state of Kentucky. And because of everything that happened with all of that, my mom went to the doctor, and he put her on a medication to kind of help calm her nerves, Valium. So as we got older and said, Mom, can leave Daddy, we were scared. We were all scared to death. We ran, we hid. I pushed my brothers out the windows to get them away from it. I mean, it was not a good life, and nobody knew about it. And you feel so alone when all of that is going on. Mom has said, I took vows, and I will stay married to your daddy. And she did. They stayed married. I know my daddy absolutely adored my mother. I know my mother grew to be very embittered with my father. She became very reclusive in her later life. And I didn't know she was addicted to Valium until we had to put her in the hospital, and I made an emergency trip home, and I was standing next to the bed with my sister, and she was going through withdrawal. And I said to my sister, God, if I didn't know better, I'd swear Mom was in withdrawal. And my sister said, you're crazy. My sister knows nothing about alcohol, drugs. And she said, you're crazy, Pat. Mom doesn't do any of that. The doctor met us at the elevator and said, how long has your mother been on Valium? My brother came to the hospital, and we asked him if he knew anything about it. And he said, well, yeah, when we lifted her up out of the bed to put her on the stretcher, there was all these pills all over the bed. When my sister was diagnosed with polio, being the oldest, I am Mom on Valium. She's cool now. She's mellow. Somebody had to take care of the two little ones and my sister. When she finally came home from the hospital, she was supposed to be put in a tub and water swirled around her and her legs and arms exercised so that she didn't, lose the muscles. She needed somebody to play with her, only she couldn't run around or do anything. So somebody had to read to her, color with her, play old maids with her while she cheated and bit the end off the old maid. And I never knew it, and I never won. And I was given my vocation of nursing. When I was 17, I went into nursing school. Now, I don't want to tell you how old I am, but they do not have dorms anymore. They do not have nursing programs. They're all collegiate programs now. So, I lived in a dorm. One weekend I came home and my dad was raging. And I don't know what happened this weekend. But I came in the house, I pulled my mother out of the house, and I said, go get in the car, and I was going to take her to a friend's house. I got my brothers out, my sister had already left for school. And I stepped into the hall, my dad had a gun in his hand. And I looked at my daddy, and I had no fear whatsoever. No sense either, but I had no fear. And I looked at him and I said, go ahead and shoot. You can't hurt me any worse than you already have. And he did. And the bullet went right beside my head, and he pulled up, fortunately, and it went into the ceiling. Went into a suitcase of a set of luggage they had given me for graduation. I found it years later. I went into nursing school, and I can tell you from that day to this, I love it. I started dating my first husband. I hope some of y'all are good in math. The numbers get higher here. He's the father of my children. He is a very good man. He was then and he is now. I love him to this day. He was my first love. That never changes. And I will also tell you that he did not drink. And as intelligent as he is, he was boring as hell. I mean, truly, he really was. To me, he was. Now, did I know I was getting the rids at that point? No. Restless, irritable, discontented? Yes. So, we were married for, 13, 14 years. And we separated. I'm working in the hospital, and there's this patient that has ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. He can't talk. I'm his nurse. I can read his lips. And he said, I need for you to go out with my son. And I'm going, what? He said, you all would be good together. Well, okay. We had our first date on January the 1st, got married the 10th of March. He decided he was going back in the Navy. And I had just gotten this promotion, and I'm going, what? Oh, well, that sounds like fun. You're going where? Barbara's Point, Hawaii. Let's go. So we take off for Barbara's Point, Hawaii. I continued my drinking. I was very active with the Navy Wives Clubs of America. It was an honor and a privilege, and I there were times I made an absolute fool of myself. And those are things you can't change. You just get to learn from them. I remember one night we were at some sort of chief's ball or something, and I had made this beautiful green velvet dress, and it had satin on it, and it was a wrap around, and I'm out there, three sheets to the wind, dancing my little butt off, and I slipped and fell, and the skirt went right in front of everybody, and I went, oh, excuse me, and somebody helped me up, and I got up and kept on dancing. These are the things I know about today, and I remember today, but at the time, right over my head. Well, this man didn't drink either. So I'm going two for two here now, and he got a little upset because while he was gone on leave one time, out to sea. I'm not a fighter, but I damn sure am a lover. And so I ended up at the Little Club in Coronado, California. I can tell you that I have a friend that just came back from there. It's still there, 23 years later. And she even emailed me a picture. And she said, you talk about this in your story, and so I wanted you to know it's still here. Thanks. And so I looked in my, later on, when I finally got into recovery, I happened to be going through some old check registers, and in there are checks, and it says TLC, 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 the Little Club. And it was kind of an eye-opener. That's exactly what I was doing. I was in there trying to fill this hole. And you wonderful gentlemen were gracious enough to help me do that. You bought my booze. You took me home, and sometimes I took you home. And when my husband came home from sea, some big mouth told him about this, and he said that what he really said was, I can't date below rank. He was a chief, and I'd gone with the first class, and he was really upset about that. Now, you only have to be in the military to understand this rationale. Okay, so you're no fun anymore. I moved to Washington State with my two children and went to work up there. And lo and behold, I went to this little bar called the 19th Hole. I don't know anything about golf. I just know they go back there to drink after they're done with their 18 holes. And in walks this guy, and he strutted like a bandy rooster. He wore cowboy boots. He had a wad of keys on his belt. And by golly, you didn't get in his way. He said, what are you drinking? And I said, thank you, but I can buy my own drinks. And he said, I didn't ask you if you could buy your own. I said, what are you drinking? And I said, I'll take care of myself. And he said to the bartender, because I didn't know he lived in there, get her a drink. Well, we struck up a little conversation. We made arrangements to have a date a couple of nights later. He went one way, and the cops went after him. He got his fourth DUI. I went the other way, went up the side of the mountain, turned the car over. Okay, the night of the date, I called him, and I wanted to let him know my car wasn't out of the shop, hadn't had repaired, and that I wasn't going to be able to meet with him. And this lady answered the phone. He told me he had a roommate, and I said, okay. He calls me, and he said, do you know who you were talking to? I said, your roommate, I assume. He said, no, that was my wife. Well, you know, these little details help if you know them. And he said, but I'll meet you anyway. Okay. He's number three. Finally, I got me a drinking man. Finally. Okay. All's well and good. Except when he got caught this time, the judge sent him to AA. The nudge from the judge. Well, you know, we were dating, but you know how you do when you date. You're kind of like in lust in bed and forever after that. Well, that's what we did. And so we were living together, and he had to go to this AA meeting. I said, I'll go with you. And he said, suits me. I don't care. I've got to go to, and he named how many. He had to go to 2 a week for a year. I said, okay. Excuse me. Okay. And so we started to the AA meeting. In the meeting, the chairperson said, if you don't have a big book, we have them to sell. If you can't afford to buy one, you can ask us. If you're too embarrassed to ask us, steal it. Thought he did good. He covered all the bases. I went to the restroom, went to get out another roll of toilet paper, and lo and behold, here's a stack of those blue books he was talking about. I stole one. I put it under my sweater. And when we were going home, I said, here, look what I got for you. He said, I don't want that thing. So I thought, oh, okay, I like to read. I went home and I read it, and there he was there, there he was there, there he was there. He was through that whole book. I couldn't believe it. Well, he kept going to those AA meetings. I would go with him to open AA meetings. I don't know where God planted the seed, but I went to one meeting, and this lady told my story about how she drank and she could quit for periods of time. I could too, I just didn't know it was called white knuckling. And I was afraid of drugs. I had a license. I had to keep my license in order to feed my children, and so I stayed away from drugs. But booze was legal, so I just stayed away from that. Well, at some point, I heard my story. And the lady I was with, who became my first sponsor, I said to her coming home from the meeting, I said, "Tricia, do you think I'm an alcoholic?" She said, "I can't answer that question for you." And I said, "Yeah, but you and I have talked, you know me." She said, "The only thing I can tell you to do is go home, read the first 164 pages of the Big Book in the Third Tradition, and you will have your answer." This was a Thursday night. I went home. I started reading that book. Well, the funny thing happened. His name wasn't in the book anymore. Mine was. I got angry. I cried. I threw the book. I picked it back up. I'd read some more. And more I realized that I was an alcoholic. The next day I sat in my office with the door closed because, Dave, I was an emotional wreck. And I didn't know what I was going to do. Saturday morning there was an AA meeting. It was called the 12 Promises meeting on Camano Island, Washington. 8 o'clock in the morning. Who ever heard of going to a meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning? But I got up and I went. And at that meeting, there was a man sitting there. I had been going to ACOA meetings. Father, it's an alcoholic. By the way, my last name's McCain. Have y'all ever heard that name before and that history? Come by it, honestly. Anyway, this man was sitting there and he had been to ACOA meetings. Now, I didn't know he was an AA. And he's sitting there, and I said hi to him. And the chairperson just called on me out of the blue and said, "Pat, you look like you have a burning desire to share." What? Because you don't share in AA meetings. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. Only declared alcoholics share in an AA meeting. Well, he knew what I didn't know until I opened my mouth. And I said, I couldn't say an adult child of an alcoholic. I said, "I'm an alcoholic." I looked over at this man sitting at the table with me, and tears are running down his face. And he said, "Welcome home. We've been waiting for you." I don't know how we know, but we know. And I think we know because God works through us to people that are suffering and cannot reach out. That was on July the 5th, 1988. I walked out of that room, and this lady that became my first sponsor said, "Well, come on, let's get in the car. We're going to Seattle. It's a two-hour drive." I said, "No, I'm not going to Seattle. I got things I got to do. You know, it's the weekend. I got laundry, clean the house." She said, "No. From this point forth, if you want sobriety, you will do what I suggest you do." She had a whole 5 years of sobriety at that point. She had a heck of a sponsor. And I said, "No, no." And I started to argue with her. She said, "No. Is not accepted in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't say no to anybody." Well, hell, I was screwed. So I said, "Okay." Now, I had been drinking on the 4th. You know, I was just a... So we get in the car, and here I am, not knowing that we go everywhere together. And she said, there's a rule. And she said, "The rule is the youngest person in sobriety rides the hump. You get in the middle." I said, "Why?" She said, "Because you need to have it pounded into you from this end up." I said, "Okay." So, her husband, Tricia, he's in recovery. He has a year more than she does. And two other people I never knew were in the car with me. We get to Seattle, and we walk into this huge ballroom, and I see all of these people, and I'm scared to death. And I feel like that little chihuahua in the back of a car, just bobbing his little head, going along, and she's saying to everybody, 2,000 people I know, and she said, "This is Pat, and she's new. Why are you telling people this stuff? I don't know I'm new." They gave me coffee and ice cream. And that's what they did all day long. Here's a cup. Creamer, sugar. I couldn't drink the stuff. It had so much syrup in it. And then they said, "We're going to go get something to eat." "Well, I don't think you want to eat. Get her a big bowl of ice cream." I still love ice cream. Well, guess where she'd taken me? My first service function. It was the committee for the International Convention in 1990. I was a greeter. I still have my hat. She introduced me to service my first day in recovery. And I am so indebted to this lady for her instilling into me the three legs of recovery, unity, and service. I have been involved in service from that day to this. And I can tell you, if you aren't working all three legacies, there's an awful good chance that you're going to, if you open one of those, you could slide out. And we don't want that to happen to anybody. I started out as being the secretary in my home group. I'm a nurse, not a secretary. They talk fast. I couldn't get it all down because I'm a perfectionist too. And I tell them to slow down. Wait a minute. 1, 2, 3. ABC. I couldn't do it. And she said, "Just relax. Do the best you can. We don't fire anybody." And I went, okay. I did what I was told to do because I was scared not to. I did not want to have those feelings I had before. That loneliness. I remember one time when I went home and I asked my brother, the one that passed away, I asked him, "Do you know where any AA meetings are?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." So he took me to an AA meeting. And I said, "Come upstairs with me, Dave. Come to the meeting with me. Just come and sit next to me." He said, "No, I'm just going to wait down here for you." And I came back downstairs, and I tell you, I got a contact high from his sitting in the car while I was in the AA meeting. He took me back to my hotel room, and it was the one and only conversation I ever had with my brother about this disease. And I said, "Dave, have you ever considered that we might have this disease of alcoholism?" He said, "I'm a drunk. I know I'm a drunk." I said, "Then why don't you do something and get over not being, you don't have to do this." And he said, "Can't do it. Just can't do it." And I said, "What about this? This hole we all have. We didn't get it filled growing up. We couldn't. Our parents had this disease. They couldn't give us what we needed." I searched out all you guys, and you gave it to me temporarily, but you couldn't fill this hole either. And David said, "I know. I hate it. I hate it. I hate that feeling in my gut." And I said, "It's big enough to put your fist through." He said, "Yes." I said, "I don't have it anymore, Dave. I don't have it. It's gone." And he said, "Well, what'd you do with it?" I said, "I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and slowly they filled my hole." He no longer has to worry about that hole. I I got a call from husband number two. I'd sent him all of his awards and stuff that he'd gotten in the Navy. He'd left him when he left. And I sent them to him one time. He sent me a Christmas card, had his information on it. And he said, give me a call sometime. So I called him, thanked him for the Christmas card. And I said, where are you? He said, Pensacola, Florida. I said, oh. He said, why don't you come down here? And I said, well, that would be awesome because that's where the sunshine is and I wouldn't have to drive in the ice ruts in Washington State anymore. He said, I'll come and get you and I'll bring you down. He did. My intention was to move to Florida to get out of the cold weather. His intention was a little differently. So we had to have several conversations about that, and then finally he began to recognize that we had different intentions for being in Florida. But I'm grateful for him to reach out to me like that and to help me to relocate to Florida. I've been here. Oh, I'm not there, am I? We'll see how that happens. Oh, man. About 12 years ago, this man walked into my office, and he had had to place his mother in a nursing home where I was director of nurses. And he came bouncing in the door. He had a gray ponytail down to here, and he literally was bouncing. Literally was back and forth on the seat. Well, during this time, I had been praying. I'd been single for 12 years. And I said, God, if it's your will, and you would like to see me with somebody, I would really enjoy having a companion in my life. Somebody speaks the same language I do, language of the heart. That you have him be tall and have a sense of humor. I'd like for you to meet my husband, Mike, who celebrated 17 years yesterday. He's fourth and final. I think we have a winning combination most days. When he's working his program and I'm working mine and we aren't working each other's. I'm supposed to tell you what it's like today. And this is important to me. I've always pretty much focused on the what it was like part. But, you know, there's no mistakes in God's plan, I do not believe. And so, he invites me to come to the Marietta Spring Roundup. I truly thank the committee for this. I thank my beautiful host, Carol, her sponsor, Mickey, and Elaine for reading. And I had an awesome time at dinner because I got to meet Miss Eleanor. My sponsor told me to pick somebody in the audience that was God with skin on it. I did. Okay. What it's like today. Go back just a little bit. In 2008, I went to Cherokee, North Carolina. I have been going to Cherokee for several years now, about eight, and I go up there twice a year. There's a camp out in May, and there is a conference in November, and it's for Cherokee, it's for Indians in sobriety. Now, I told you I was Irish. When you go up there, you are welcomed as one of them. It has been a spiritual experience for me to be able to be involved with their way of life. It's opened my eyes. And I think anywhere we can go in our journey, in whatever we read, what classes we go to, whatever it is that touches us is meant to be because my whole purpose in recovery is not to stay sober, although that's a good benefit. My whole journey is to get and know my God, whoever that is to me. That's my whole purpose. In 2008, I went to Cherokee with two of my sisters in sobriety. I had a very bad fall up there on an uneven slate floor. Now, Mike will tell you I'm not a lady when I fall. I'm there 1 minute and gone the next, and I go down hard. And I did. I hit my head, and as a result, I sustained a whiplash-type injury to my neck. I went to the doctor. He took x-rays. He said, nothing's broken. And I said, why do I feel like I've been run over by a Mack truck? And he said, well, that happens when a movable force meets an immovable object. And I said, okay. This was in February. By May, I couldn't move. I couldn't get up out of a chair without calling Mike, have him lift me up, and just literally collapsing in tears. I was in so much pain. I went back to the doctor, and I said, something is wrong. I am supposed to be running around doing all this stuff. I kept getting more and more depressed because I couldn't move. I'm an active person, and so he took an x-ray and he said, I think I'll send you for an MRI. He sent me for an MRI. He called me. 3 days later, I was having a total hip replacement done. When I had fallen, I crushed the blood vessels that fed the hip and the hip died. It was an experience, to say the least. Went through physical therapy and finally got going again. Came into this past year, 2010, and I was still getting treatments for my neck. I mean, I had been through everything. And it came down, I was getting injections in my neck, and finally I said, this can't go on like this. I mean, I'm not one to prolong medical treatment. He said, here are your choices. He said, you can have a stimulator put in your spine that may help the pain. That's 50-50. You can take pain medication and muscle relaxants. I went, oh no, those things make me goofy. He said, or you can learn to live with it. Okay, so I learned to live with it. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. In January, I started counseling for PTSD. When I was 13 years sober, God bless Mike. I mean, he came into my life and I went, he said it was like living with the Exorcist. He didn't know when I was going to start throwing up pea soup. Oh, God, I started on hormones, and that didn't work. It was bad. Anyway, I also started having flashbacks and panic attacks. I have no idea what's going on with me. I was blessed to have a lady that's in counseling that is also in recovery. And I talked to her, and she said, I think I know what your problem is. Come and see me. So I started seeing her. And what I learned was I had been sexually abused from the age of 2. And I have had multiple perpetrators. Because you don't understand how you throw out vibes to men. You just don't. That original abuse changes your whole perspective on life. And it's not just women this happens to. This happens to men also. I spent 2 years in therapy. Mike drove me to Tallahassee, a 2-hour drive. I would go into therapy on Saturday afternoon, so I didn't have to deal with anybody else in the office. He would go to Home Depot and Lowe's. Going back, he had to be quiet because I was ultra-stimulated, and I had to have it quiet. We made it through that. We made it through. Oh, dear. In February, I'm sponsoring ladies. I'm a Red Cross volunteer. I had started a big book study at a recovery home for women. I'm being sponsored. I was the voice. No, I was the chairperson for the second year in a row of the Gulf Coast Roundup. Mike was the corrections chair at area, and I was sponsoring the area delegate. So you can't say I wasn't active in Alcoholics Anonymous. March, I got called for jury duty, and that was an experience. I loved it. I'm a legal nurse consultant now. That's why I loved it. May, I had my first cataract surgery. Oh, I had this brilliant idea. Oh, Lord. Some people can do this and some people can't. Give you a heads up. I have a little sponsee, and we talked, and she was homeless. She was living in her car. So Mike and I said, oh, come on, live with us. If you can tolerate three cats and a little Pikachu, come on in. She came in. Wasn't there 2 days, and she got into all our meds. Mike's on medication for rheumatoid arthritis. If she takes this medication, which is a cancer drug, it could kill her. Not to mention everything else she got into. I mean, she was chewing Advil, Tylenol, stuff we don't take, but it's there because it's just the two of us. She's hallucinating in the middle of the night. She's calling the police because people are after. I mean, it was just such fun. And I'm going, what was I thinking? Well, yeah, exactly. We had the foresight to have her sign a contract with us that if she breached her sobriety, we would have to ask her to leave. And after being up 2 nights in a row, Mike came home from work, and I'm a zombie, and he said, she's got to go. Sometimes you need your partner to be the strength you can't be. And I didn't want to give up on her. I didn't want her to have to go back to living in that car. It's all going somewhere, folks. In July, I graduated from therapy. Yay! But see, I ain't well, so watch it. I attended the area assembly and went to Mississippi to support my sponsee who was speaking. Mike quit his job to take a job on the beach, cleaning the beach. 2 days later, they decided they didn't need the help on the beach. And he's been without work since. Oh, it's been great fun. In August, my son, who's 39 years old, had to go to surgery. He had a very major infection, and he had to go into surgery. I also had gone down and reunited with my daughter, who had for 20 years kept me at arm's length. I spent 2 weeks with my grandson when he was 4 and didn't seem, except briefly, like once every 5 or 6 years, and never had had time with my granddaughter. My son is the one that told his sister, you know, at some point you gotta let mom off the hook. She hasn't had anything to drink in over 20 years, so you gotta get over it. And I kept telling him, she will when she's supposed to, when it's her time, when her hurt ebbs enough to be able for us to talk. We met at his house, and we visited, and we were healing. And we're still doing that today. We call each other, which we didn't do before. The next week, my granddaughter came for a visit. Now, her mom was gone, and I had her all by myself. She's 19 years old. She's absolutely gorgeous, just my opinion. And, no, she really is. It's scary gorgeous. And we went shopping. If you've never been shopping with your granddaughters, it's an experience. She took me to Victoria's Secret. I'd never been in the store. What have they got in there? I can... She took me in there, and she fixed me up. And I got to learn all about Juicy Couture. Does anybody know about it? I'm telling you, it was a glorious time. My bank account was affected tremendously, but she went home happy. When Jim had to go to surgery, Mike and I went down. I didn't know how sick my son had been with this infection. My son has got a beautiful home in West Palm Beach. And he's still single, in case anybody's interested. And he's a good housekeeper. I mean, he's a guy. He stacks stuff. He's ADD. But anyway, well, so is he. So I got it on both sides. So we walk in there, and this house is filthy. And I'm going, this isn't Jim's house. Well, what I didn't know is he wasn't tired as a result of this infection. He was totally fatigued. He could do nothing. And I mean that seriously. He honestly couldn't do anything. After he went to surgery, Mom had to put on the nurse's hat again. I changed the dressing every day. It was difficult. It was in the nether regions where his surgery was. And that was hard for us. That was very hard for us. But I can change it like that. Hat goes on, it's no longer Mom, it's a nurse. And I took care of him till we got him back on his feet. Somewhere along this line here and around that same time, he adopted a stray, a pit bull and boxer. And the next month, the dog bit him. Back to surgery for a crushed finger and lacerated hand. And the hardest part was he had to have the dog put down. My son loves his dogs. He was heartbroken, and when your child's heart is broken, you are crushed. We went back down, helped again. Okay. November, I had to put my sobriety kitty down. Now, the reason I call her my sobriety kitty is when I was about 4 months sober, a man on Camino Island came up to me and he gave me this little white kitten. And he said, "You take care of her and she will take care of you." It's nice to have somebody to take care of when you don't know how to take care of yourself. She lived for 22 years. She made every damn geographic I made. And when I moved into the house, which is over 100 years old, into Funiac Springs, I promised her I'd never make her leave again. She held me to it. December the 5th, it's dark, it's cold. Cold? Tell me, cold? I mean, y'all had snow, but we were freezing to death. I got a phone call from my sponsor. My sponsor is from Tonga. And she speaks with a real thick accent. Absolutely beautiful lady. And she said, "Pat." And I said, "Yes, Susie." She said, "You come to meeting." I said, "When?" "Now." The meeting was at 6:00. It was 5:30. And it's a good 20-minute drive to the meeting. I said, "Tonight?" And she said, "Yes." Okay. Way back here in the back of my head was, you don't ever say no. I said, now this was stupid. "Do you really think I need to?" See, you don't really get smarter just because you got numbers behind your name. And she said, "Why you think I call you?" I got up, I got dressed, I got in the car. And going out to the meeting, I realized I was in a severe depression. I felt like I was walking through molasses. I had this gray drape over me. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to die. I didn't want to be. I got to the meeting and I said to Susie, "Susie, I am depressed." "Yes, yes, I know. That's why I call you." "Well, why didn't you call me sooner?" "I just found this out. God talked to me." She says this. "I can tell you this lady has told me almost daily for the last year these words. Trust God. Clean house. Help others." I couldn't help more people than I already was. I couldn't do it. On December the 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, how ironic, she's sitting at my dining room table, and I have a meltdown. And I said, "I don't know what's going on with me." "I do." "Tell me." "Look at your hands." I was sitting there like this, my hands clenched in front of me. And she said, "Look, look, look what you've done all year long. You hold everything. Hold everything. You don't let nothing go. You don't talk to God. He's there for you. You think you can do it all." She said, "Take your hands apart." "Turn them over." "Okay." She said, "Now reach underneath that, all that weight, and lift it up to God." There's no mistakes in God's plan. What I came to realize, I had been in a serious spiritual relapse. I have been spending that time since then reading, praying, and meditating. The RPMs for the RIDS. I came across something I want to share with you that has helped me immensely. It's a Chinese legend. Once upon a time, in the heart of the Western Kingdom, lay a beautiful garden. And there in the cool of the day, the master of the garden liked to walk. Of all the denizens of the garden, the most beautiful and most beloved was a gracious and noble bamboo. Year after year, bamboo grew yet more noble and gracious. And often when wind came to revel in the garden, bamboo would cast aside his grave stateliness to dance and play right merrily, tossing and swaying and leaping and bowing in joyous abandon, leading the great dance of the garden, which most delighted the master's heart. Now upon a day, the master himself drew near to contemplate his bamboo with eyes of curious expectancy. And bamboo, in a passion of adoration, bowed his great head to the ground in loving greeting. The master spoke, "Bamboo, bamboo, I would use thee." Bamboo flung his head to the sky in utter delight. The day of days had come, the day for which he had been made, the day to which he had been growing hour by hour, the day to which he would find his completion and his destiny. His voice came low, "Master, I am ready. Use me as thy wilt." "Bamboo," the master's voice was grave, I would take thee and cut thee down. A trembling of great horse shook bamboo. Cut me down? Me, whom thy master has made the most beautiful in all thy garden? Cut me down? Ah, not that, not that. Use me for thy joy, O master, but cut me not down. Beloved bamboo, the master's voice grew graver still. If I cut thee not down, I cannot use thee. The garden grew still. Wind held his breath. Bamboo slowly bent his proud and glorious hand. Then came a whisper. Master, if thou cannot use me without cutting me down, then do thy will and cut. Bamboo, beloved bamboo, I would cut thy leaves and branches from thee also. Master, master, spare me. Cut me down, lay my beauty in the dust, but must I take from me my leaves and branches also? Bamboo, if I cut them not away, I cannot use thee. The sun hid his face, a listening butterfly guided fearfully away. And bamboo shivered in terrible expectancy, whispering low, Master, cut away. Bamboo, bamboo, I would cleave thee in two and cut out thine heart, for if I cut not so, I cannot use thee. Then was bamboo bowed to the ground, Master, master, then cleave and cut. So did the master of the garden take bamboo and cut him down, and hack off his branches and strip off his leaves, and cleave him in two and cut out his heart. And lifting him gently, the master carried him to where was a spring fresh, sparkling water in the midst of his dry fields. Then putting one end of broken bamboo in the spring and the other end into the water channel in his field, the master laid down gently his beloved bamboo. And the spring sang welcome, and the clear sparkling waters raced joyously down the channel of bamboo's torn body into the waiting fields. Then the rice was planted, and the days went by, and the shoots grew, and the harvest came. And that day was bamboo, once so glorious in his stately beauty, yet more glorious in his brokenness and humility. For in his beauty he was life abundant, but in his brokenness he became a channel of abundant life to his master's world. As Bill Wilson wrote in the story in the Grapevine about emotional sobriety, where he shares with us the very experience I have had this last year. At the end of it, he says, I search for a quiet mind in the bright sunshine. I wish you all a peaceful heart and a quiet mind. Thank you.